Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Right Stream Radio Network, and this is Military Monday. My name is John Gresham. I'm your host for the day. And this week we are going to go and talk a little about World War II. Now, it's the 70th anniversary of D-Day on Friday. It's going to be quite the affair. In fact, last week's guest, Marty Morgan, is presently leading a tour group over in Normandy, along with Kevin Heimel, another friend of the show. And they will go and show their people a great deal about D-Day. But today we're going to talk about another aspect of World War II, the fact that it wasn't just fought by Americans and British. There was another side. And in this particular case, we're going to talk about some of the Germans that fought during World War II and the period we're talking about. And we're not going to talk about Germany from a standpoint of being the aggressor or necessarily even the bad guy for its various policies along the lines of race, ethnicity, and other factors. We're going to talk about some actual honorable warriors. We're going to talk about the German aces of the Luftwaffe. These were really quite extraordinary men. And we say men because there were no women, per se, flying active combat in the German Air Force, unlike the Soviets. And today we've gone and brought on a pair of guests, for the first time, actually, a husband and wife duo, who have written a pair of really great books for Zenith Press called The German Aces and The German Aces Speak Too. To this end, I'm talking about Mr. Colin Heaton and his wife, Anne-Marie Lewis. And we're going to bring them on and let them talk about these extraordinary and quite intriguing gentlemen. Colin, Anne-Marie, are you there?
Yes, hi. How are you?
Yep,
very,
you?
Very well. Colin, you with us as well?
Oh, yeah.
I want to thank you both for coming on. I know this came together rather quickly. And I'd like to start by, I'm going to let you guys sort this out since I'm sure you have gotten some sort of order to your working relationship. Where did this interest in German fighter pilots begin for both of you? And I'd like to hear from both of you about this. Let's start with Colin because I know this goes back quite a ways with you.
Oh, yeah. Back when I was a boy and we started reading books around age 4 or 5, I began picking up some books on World War II and history in general, but I was fascinated by the stories of fighter pilots, reading the books of Ed Sims and Ray Tolliver and Trevor Constable and several others, and that's really where it all started.
And it just kind of got out of control from there.
Yeah, let's say I developed a bad habit that stayed with me.
And where did you pick this up, or did you marry into it?
I actually married into it, but we met through our work, basically. Me as a photographer working, covering the Doolittle Raiders. So essentially our work dovetailed together, and my interest in the German aces came from Colin's work, basically, after meeting at the Doolittle Raiders reunion that year. So we were basically on the same track.
And I understand that the Doolittle Raiders took quite a shining to you at one point.
Oh, actually, yes, they did. We had a really good time when I covered their events. I mean, it was a lot of fun. They're very personable and very noble and wonderful people. It was an honor to be able to sit and talk with them when I was able to photograph them at their event. It was really nice.
Some great Americans and great warriors in that group. Certainly people we remember very fondly these days.
Absolutely.
I want to start with Colin. you talked earlier about reading books by some authors that a lot of people have never heard of. And it's worth saying that after World War II, there was kind of a gap in historic scholarship regarding what the Axis warriors did during their war. We're going to be talking more about that later this summer on a couple of shows. But let's talk specifically where you were talking about some authors, Ray Tolliver, Trevor Constable, and Edward H. Sims. Who were these men, and what was their contribution to starting the scholarship on German aces and their fights?
Well, Edward Sims was about the first American historian to really start interviewing and talking with the American aces of the war. It almost seemed to have lost its luster after 1945, and there really wasn't that much material interest in their efforts. And then he wrote his books, The American Fighter Aces, and some others. And then Trevor Constable and Ray Tolliver began meeting with some of the Germans because he wanted to get their, they wanted to get their stories. And that evolved into Herido, The Fighter Aces of the Luftwaffe, later The Blonde Knight in Germany, which is Eric's biography, and Adolf Dahlen's biography, Fighter in General. And so I absorbed all those books, and that's really, for me, the hook. That's what got me into this.
Looking at their early work, and all of us who are historians and authors know, we go and we climb on the shoulders of those who came before us, and they elevate us in our work. How did those men go and affect your approach when you started looking seriously at this subject and began working it 30 years ago?
Well, back in the 70s, I first met my few German pilots through Jimmy Doolittle, in fact. And then I managed to establish contact with Ray and Jan Tolliver. And then for decades, Ray was always very helpful, along with Trevor Constable, in giving me information and supplying me with photographs, which make up the bulk of my Luftwaffe collection, and not to mention the privately signed ones that I gathered from the men themselves. But I wanted to get more information, and Ray suggested that I go straight to the sources. So they basically were the reason and the rationale for my being involved in the first place on a first-person basis.
It's a matter of record that the former Axis nations in the post-war period went quite a ways, sometimes even enacting laws which limited the, if not the respectful observance, certainly the celebration of World War II activities. For example, you know, model kits could not be sold in Germany that had swastikas on them. And in Japan, authors like Saburo Sakai were very much, shall we say, encouraged not to go and write about their World War II activities. Talk a little bit about the early problems you ran into in eking out these stories and what they faced after World War II.
Well, I didn't really have much trouble getting them to talk. After a couple of bottles of wine or a case of beer, there's a lot of good conversations that develop. They found that it was quite interesting that someone who was an American of the younger generation would even have an interest in their exploits, because no one in Germany really cared except for a few historians like the historian Hans Ring and Arno Abendroth and those kind of fellows, Franz Karowski. But those books were not widely distributed in Germany, and they were not translated into English until the last decade or so. And as I met with them, and I explained to them that there was a real avid interest in the States still from their times of visiting and signing books and things of that nature or being at symposiums. They just opened up and opened up their archives, they opened up their photos, opened up their diaries, and directed to other people. It was pretty much a watershed effect, and it just benefited me and it benefited them, because even though historians wrote about them, very few wrote about them and let them speak in their own words.
And when you entered into this interesting partnership, what did you observe in the way of the process by which you and Colin would approach a former foreign warrior, a fighter pilot, someone like that? Mm-hmm. How do you go and approach them, get to know them? What is it? What is the process that you guys used in your as you remember it?
Well, basically, since Colin had the opportunity and was able to gather the data over all the years, he really knew in-depth in person. And me, I could take the data, basically, that he synthesized through the interviews and the actual words and read through it and find the cohesive part of it. I'm basically the mortar in between all of it. You know, I'll take it and, you know, go through it and make sure that it all flows together. But I learned so much about the people as they evolve through the process of their own words, and that's pretty much where I come into the picture. I'm able to look at it as an outsider, and if I find something that's difficult to understand because I'm not from the military or I didn't experience, you know, the in-depth interview he did by himself, I can ask the questions as the person reading it on the outside looking in. So that way we can bring it as a product someone can read as an outsider and totally understand it easily, and it's not as difficult to understand. So that's basically what I do with it.
Colin, I've done the vast majority of my books as collaborations. Obviously, my first seven were with Mr. Clancy, but I've also done it with some pretty good writers like Ian Westwall, Norman Pulmar, and Dwight Zimmerman. What has been your experience in this collaboration with the person who is also your life partner? I mean, how does it work for you guys? I know that each one of my relationships with my co-authors was different, but at the end of the day, I could walk away from them. What's yours like?
Well, Anne's always told me that I could walk away whenever she didn't like, I didn't like something that she did. But but the beauty of it is that I married someone who's smarter than me, so that's a good thing. But the good thing about Anne is with her education experience and her attention to detail, that because I'm so familiar with the work, it's easy to overlook. There's an old saying I told my students when I was a professor, it's very hard to edit your own work because you're so close to it. And having her look at it as an outsider looking in, she's able to synthesize that data and take it from reading like a pharmaceutical prescription to something that people will actually buy.
So you actually find having, I don't want to use the word novice, but certainly someone who is not wedded to the material the way that you and I would be, do you find that it makes you a better writer and your work more readable across a wider audience?
Oh, absolutely, because I look at it analytically and I write the ingredients, and Anne's really good at taking the raw data and saying, well, you need to really restructure this so it makes more sense to the average layman. And that's where her strengths come in, because even our agent has even said that when she read the first seven or eight books that I did, that until Anne got her hands on them, that they were unmarketable. So I owe her that.
Anne, in terms of the material as it's generated, what form do the interviews and the media that you collect take, and how do you manage them in your working environment?
Well, usually Colin already has the interviews in their raw form, so we have to basically get them down first in that way. But afterwards, what I do is I just take it and I break it down into its components, and I just take it through the process and look at it as if I had no idea about who these people were and what they had to say, and let it come through with their own words. So I take it and I break it down into its various component units, and I analyze it as an outsider. So essentially, I just work the raw data.
Okay. And with the process and the partnership, as well as the foundations explained, let's talk about the subject, which in this case is a very interesting group of people, a very select group of people, and, oh, by the way, a group of people who, as our mutual friend Barrett Tillman has said, is rapidly dwindling. And these are, of course, the young men who now are old men who were the top fighter aces of the Luftwaffe. Colin, talk, if you will, about who these men were and where did they come from? What were their origins?
Well, most of them were Germans. All of the ones in the books were all born in Germany, except some Kopensky, who was born in modern-day Poland back when it was part of the old German Empire. But they were just a bunch of guys who, and for the most part, had an interest in flying from a young age, like most pilots. Regardless of their national origin, young men have ambitions and dreams, and Gallen just wanted to be a commercial airline pilot. Circumstances and the misfortunes of National Socialist Germany took his dream away from him, and he was forced into becoming a fighter pilot. And in interviewing these guys, you get to see, and knowing them for many years in some cases, decades, in fact, you get to see the inner character of a man. And after doing 400-plus interviews with various people, you get over time the essence of not only who the person was, but what their feelings were at the time. And some of the humanity of these men comes out, which is something that I think was left out of the post-war rhetoric and post-war literature in most of the publications that people read.
Now, these young gentlemen, and they were very much young gentlemen at the time, they did not have the opportunity to fly in the way that other countries did, because of course the restrictions on Germany regarding aviation, which were embedded in the words of the Versailles Treaty, were very strict. Correct?
Yeah, they were. They had the Reichswehr was limited to 100,000 men. They could not have an air force. They couldn't have a U-boat service. Their navy was limited to 10,000-ton warships. So, you know, it was a very difficult time for Germany, even with the post-Versailles Treaty war reparations clause imposed upon them, that they didn't have the financial backing, the financial ability, and they sure did not have the legality of basically rebuilding their military to anything resembling a first world status until 1933, when Hitler took the oath of office. Well, then he started this agreement with Stalin, where he would send his pilots and soldiers and other military personnel to the Soviet Union to secretly train while he supplied the Soviet Union with the materiel needed for their industry.
And, of course, to teach people how to fly, they went back to the basics, which was gliders. Talk a little bit about the glider clubs and programs.
Yeah, well, one of the things that was unique about Germany was that due to the shortages of fuel and materiel, that you had a lot of glider clubs that were formed, and the civilians would build their gliders, and they would have these World War I pilots who would inspect them, and they would run down a hill with a clothesline and launch it off a cliff and hope nobody died in the process. Well, later that developed into an official glider program, and those young men and even some girls who were involved in the glider program were exempt from being members of the Hitler Youth directly. They were considered the progenitors of what would later be the Luftwaffe, which is how all the pilots got their training. They all started in gliders to learn powerless flight and controlled landings, and then they went to biplane H-51 types, and then they would graduate to monowing fighters or bombers.
And you've obviously been there as Colin has conducted the interviews over the years. What is your impression of these men as people? What were your dominant impressions of them as a group? We understand that fighter pilots are some of the most individual individuals around, but you must have seen certain trends and facets that you found common among the group. Talk about them as people a bit, if you will.
Well, I was not with my husband when he conducted the interviews. Those interviews he conducted over the past, you know, there were over 20 years before I met him. And those were his personal interviews. I came through knowing more about these gentlemen through being able to read the personal interviews that Colin himself conducted over the 20 years. And what I found really intriguing was there was a sense of nobility, almost a chivalry of all of the pilots. They were very noble men, and they held a code of honor that was unlike anything else you would see anywhere else in the world. They were very noble, and through their own words, you know, through the interviews in the books, it was amazing to be able to learn the where, the what, the where, and how and why they were what they were as men, like from when they were young, learning to fly up until how they progressed throughout the process to becoming the men they were later as fighter pilots. I mean, their accomplishments were amazing. And it was just it was fascinating to see through their own words that they were there was like a brotherhood amongst them all, and there's a certain nobility. For example, you know, if someone was had shot someone down, and they were able to make a kill shot. Some of these men would actually not even make a kill shot. They would simply note that the pilot was going down, and in fact, the pilot went down, and the other person, the German, would simply go by and let the person go down. They wouldn't make the kill blow on their own. They would allow the pilot a chance to bail out and be picked up later on. So that was a certain nobility. They didn't just go out bloodthirsty and take everything down. There was a note of chivalry amongst all the pilots. They all knew that someone was waiting for the other person at home, too. So that
was
something.
As someone who grew up in America and has mm-hmm. been, shall we say, inculcated with the impressions that our government has given us regarding Nazi Germany, how do you reconcile this group with the country they were fighting for? I mean, how do you as an individual go and reconcile these people in your mind?
There is nothing really to reconcile when you understand that the pilots themselves lived in their own barracks and their own existence away from what was going on actually back at the mechanisms, with Hitler and everything. They were basically men that were fighting for their country, and that's what they believed in. They didn't know about a lot of the things that were going on the ground like people would normally believe. They would assume that they knew about the Jewish people and what was happening, and it's not true. They didn't know. A lot didn't find out until much later, and by then there was nothing they could have done about it. It's kind of interesting that people would think that someone would be able to oppose Hitler and get away with it and survive, and yet many of these men actually did in their lives. So it was it's pretty interesting to be able to look at what they are as people and understand where they came from as a country, fighting for their own country, and as aviators be able to respect what they did as flyers, what they were able to accomplish with their talents.
Colin, the other day when we were first talking, setting up the show, you made a very strong point that I'd like you to, if you would, please reiterate, and that is a surprising number, in fact, a very large percentage of people, not just in the Luftwaffe, but also across the German military, were not only not Nazis, but in fact were apolitical through much of the war, as much as they could be under the circumstances. Talk a little bit specifically about this detail regarding the German pilots and what you have discovered in your research over the years.
Well, basically, there was a German law that had been in existence since the unification of Germany under Bismarck, and it was re-ratified under the Weimar Republic post-World War I, and that was called the Überparteilichkeit, which was above party affiliation, which meant that professional military officers were not allowed to belong to any political parties. And under the Weimar regime, there were 52, 54 political parties in Germany. They didn't want officers owing their allegiance to any political collective. They wanted their affiliation limited to only loyalty to the country. And therefore, it became a federal law that professional officers could not join political parties. And, of course, when Hitler came to power, he outlawed all other parties. Only the National Socialists remained, which then it became an non sequitur because the men couldn't belong to a party before, so why don't they join a party now?
Okay, fair enough. And I'm going to ask the last question, and you can both, before the break, and you both can go ahead and answer this. I've had the pleasure of meeting a number of these gentlemen, including Galland and Hartmann and a couple of others, but I'd like to hear from you. Did you like these guys? Were they fun? Were they humorous? What kind of personalities did they have? And Anne, I'd like to start with you. What were your impressions when you actually got to meet them?
Okay, well, I wasn't able to meet them in person, but I was able to meet them through their own words in their interviews. As I said before, Colin was the one that conducted the interviews over the 20 years. But through the work, I was able to read the interviews in person, and what I found about them is that they had a very sincere and honest approach to how they explained what their lives were and what they were and the effect the war had on their lives. So I found that they were very honest and straightforward men, and I found that they also had a very good sense of humor on what could be a very bitter topic of remembrance in their lives. And they also all share the same thing in the fact that they did what they did, and they loved what they did, and they wanted to fly, and they wanted to fight for their country, and they were a part of history. So I was able to get to know them through their own words, through the interviews that Colin conducted with them over the years, and I found them to be very interesting and very, very intriguing people.
Colin, and I have worked around fighter pilots for most of our lives. Do you concur with the observations that Ann made?
Oh, I do, but I had the great privilege of getting drunk with most of them, so I have that additional experience. But each of the guys was a different personality and individual, as we all are, but they all had one thing in common, and that was they had a sincere interest in making sure that the truth got out, not the propaganda, not the post-war rhetoric, but they wanted to have the information accurate. And over the years, as I wrote, I would send the material in for them to review, so that way whatever you read was basically approved by them in their own hand, and I still see the letters where they made corrections. Kropinski was a very unique character. He was the most outgoing of all. He's the kind of guy who would hit you on the back and make sure you never run out of beer. Steinhoff was a little reserved, but he was very, very intelligent and very articulate and very carefully selective when he chose his words. Gallen was very fun to be with. He was a remarkable guy who would like of any party when he walked in the room.
Total character. Having met the man myself, I can only say, I mean, he always had a cigar. I mean, he was like Groucho Marx that way.
Yeah, well, he had to quit smoking like, you know, a couple of decades before his death, of course, because he had developed emphysema. But McGallum was a great guy, and he was always very helpful. And Hartman was very reserved unless he got to know you. But once he got to know you, he would call you and say, hey, when are you coming over? Okay, great. You know, I'll be over there maybe 2 weeks. And Wolfgang Falk, I was his house guest along with Gunther Rall many times, spending days, if not a week at a time with them, doing interviews and just running around and going to the Pilstubas. So what you have is basically a collection of guys who were lucky enough to have survived the war but didn't mind discussing it, even right down to the nuts and bolts of what they hated about it.
One last question. Obviously, at various times during the war and then later in the post-war period, the German pilots would mix with their former opponents and enemies, British, Americans, whatever. What kind of a relationship did they have with their former enemies, and what kind of camaraderie did you see develop between them after the war?
Oh, they had a great relationship. In fact, I was with a lot of the German pilots who retired as colonels or generals, and they would meet their former American, British, South African, New Zealand, Australian counterparts, and they had a great time. The only point of contention that I noticed a couple of times were when former Soviet pilots would show up, and they would eyeball each other across the room, almost like two Western gunfighters ready to see who would draw first. But after a few drinks, sitting down, it was okay. In fact, I was with Kropinski once when a pilot, I think his name was Kubinev, a Ukrainian fellow, Kropinski had shot down two of his wingmen and riddled his aircraft, his Yak. And Kropinski flew alongside him and waved off, and he watched him crash, land, and get out. Well, come to find out, they compared notes and found out Kropinski was, in fact, the guy who shot down the three aircraft, and he's thanked Kropinski for not killing him because he introduced us to his wife and his daughter and his grandchildren. So that was kind of interesting.
We're going to talk a little bit more about these individuals, and we will talk about individuals after the break. This is the Right Stream Radio Network.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Right Stream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Right Stream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. WriteStream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the WriteStream Radio Network.
It's
Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to WriteStream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvez. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the WriteStream Radio Network.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
And welcome back. This is Military Monday, and we're talking to Colin Heaton and his wife, Anne Marie Lewis, about their books. The German Aces Speak and The German Aces Speak 2 from Zenith Press. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the individuals that are there. And Colin, Anne, are you back with us?
Yes.
Yeah, hi.
Okay, great. And I'd like to start with someone who spent a lot of time here in the United States and is fairly familiar to a lot of Americans, and that is Adolf Galland, affectionately known as Dofo to his friends, and an interesting individual that before he was 30, he was made a general and head of the Luftwaffe fighter force, personally by Hitler. And Colin, Anne, talk about Dofo.
Well, Adolf was a very unique character. He also had three brothers, one who became a lawyer and two others became fighter pilots, Paul and Wilhelm, and both of them became Knight's Cross recipients, very successful fighter aces, but they were both killed during the war. And Dolfo was the kind of guy, he was a very chivalrous man, and as were all the Luftwaffe pilots to a large degree, because they were trained and groomed by the cadre of First World War aviators who lived by that chivalrous code that was basically shared amongst the Allies and the Central Powers during World War One. And as they became pilots and officers, they began to feel this, the Germans call it Ritterlich, or chivalry, that continued on through the war. And the best example with Galland was when Douglas Bader was shot down, Bader's Bus Company, as it was known, with Johnny Johnson's group, and DG-26, one of the pilots shot him down, and Bader had two artificial legs, of course, you know the story well, where Galland went against Goering's orders and actually told the British in a transmission that they could airdrop a pair of replacement legs for Bader because his were left in the aircraft. And so they dropped his legs after bombing his airfield. But they treated their downed aviators as special guests until they were taken to the prisoner of war camps.
And the man was movie star handsome, played the part. What kind of a pilot was he, though? Let us say right here and now, one of the aspects that impresses aviation historians like yourself and myself is that the Germans had over 100 fighter aces who all scored over 100 kills, a feat not one Allied pilot ever matched. And Dofo was one of those 100. He had over 100 kills.
Yeah, he had 104.
And what kind of a pilot was he? What made him this kind of an expert fighter pilot?
Well, Galland was not that unique amongst most of the other pilots. Most people need to understand the reason why some of these German pilots scored such high kills was because they had no rotation period. I mean, they could fly for weeks or months on end, whereas an American fighter pilot would have his 50 mission limit. He would rotate to the States, or he could extend if he wished to and fly 100, but then he would be sent back as an instructor. They kept recycling experience to produce more pilots. The Germans didn't have that. The only instructors the Germans had were old pilots who couldn't fly or those too wounded to fly. And that was a great detriment, because during the war, 70,000 men were trained to fly aircraft, 25,000 were trained to fly fighters, and less than 2,400 survived the war, so that shows you the attrition rate. And the second thing of importance to note is that from 1939 to 1945, you had guys like Steinhoff and Galland, who had flown in the Spanish Civil War before that, who flew for 6 years until they were either captured or wounded. And there was no respite for these guys. So if you average Johnny Johnson and his missions, or Robert S. Johnson, the P-47 ace, if you look at their kill ratio to missions flown, had they flown 5 or 6 years, they would have also achieved those ratios.
Okay, which then raises the question. In your mind, were they better because they were because of the duration in which they flew, or were they just luckier?
They weren't better. They weren't better pilots than American or British pilots, or even some of the Soviet Red Banner pilots. They just flew longer tours of duty, and they were lucky. I mean, any German fighter pilot you ever interview will tell you, I'm lucky to be here. Why? Because when a German pilot on the Western Front took off to engage B-17s, he might have 20 aircraft against 500 bombers and half that number, not that same number of fighter escorts. So to survive the war was one thing, let alone achieve those victories. And every single one of these men, with few exceptions like Hartman, were wounded multiple times. I like the listeners understand that George Peter Ayer only had 78 victories, but he flew over 400 missions. But he shot down 17 times, wounded 14 times, and had 3 collisions, 2 in the Me-262 jet against bombers. I mean, so this guy was lucky to even be alive at the end of the war. And most of the American pilots, British pilots, never flew those tours of duty, and they never really engaged in the type of war that the Germans did. And the Germans being on the defensive from 1944 onward, when a German was shot down, he was over home territory. He jumped back into an aircraft and went back in the air, whereas Americans, British pilots became POWs. So the German pilot being shot down wasn't out of the war. He was simply shifted to a new aircraft.
So their longevity in many cases had to do as much as anything with the fact they were fighting over their own home territory, and if they had to bail out, they were doing so into friendly hands usually.
Yeah, just like the British pilots during the Battle of Britain. I mean, RAF pilots or Commonwealth or foreign pilots bailing out over the British Isles were able to be collected and put back into flying status, whereas Germans were bailed out in the Channel over England became prisoners of war.
Another interesting pilot, maybe not as flamboyant as Adolf Galland, but nevertheless a great fighter leader, was Edwin Neumann, who was commander of the wing that went to Africa.
Yeah, Edward Norton was a very, very honorable, very unique character, and I loved him very much. I stayed at his house in Munich on occasion, and he was a remarkable human being. He had flown with Galland and Lutzoff and some of the others, Gustav Rodel and fame, supporting Franco during the Civil War. And despite having only 13 victories, he was probably one of the best administrators and one of the best logisticians in the Luftwaffe. And he was a very, very respected man up to the day he died.
And he had that unique quality that he was a great leader of great warriors. Talk a little bit about his one prodigal yet brilliant fighter pilot, a young man who is known today as the Lion of Africa.
Yeah, Hans Jochen Marseille. He was a very remarkable person because, first of all, my friend Herbert Ehlefeld, who had over 120 victories, was his first squadron leader in LG-2 in 1939-40. And then Ehlefeld fired him because of his recalcitrant attitude towards discipline. And then Steinhoff, Johannes Steinhoff, became his squadron leader in JG-52. On the Channel Coast near Calais, and then he had to fire him because Marseille kept showing up drunk with strange women and stealing his car and failing to show for duty. So he shipped him off to JG-27 in the Balkans. Eddie Norman was working under Bernard Boldinga, who I knew as well, and then they went to North Africa. Well, because there were no women, no clubs, and little alcohol, Marseille had no choice but become a better fighter pilot. And of course, in the course of 14, 15 months in Africa, he shot down another 151 aircraft for a total of 158.
Which is an incredible performance, given the fact that all of those victories were against top flight RAF aircraft and pilots.
Mm-hmm.
These were not hairballs on the other side. These were good pilots and the best airplanes the Commonwealth could provide.
Yeah, up until the early part, mid part of 42, the Curtiss 240 and the Hurricane were the two primary fighters that were totally outclassed by the 109S. But when the Spitfires came in, that changed the equation. And Marseille's toughest dogfight was a one-on-one against a Spitfire pilot. He won the fight, but it was almost 30 minutes of combat, and that was right before he died in his accident. That it was the only dogfight he was ever in that made him lose his nerve. And he broke down. They thought he was mentally ill afterwards. So these guys were from all over the British Empire, and they even the American volunteers flying with some of the squadrons in Egypt were involved in this.
In addition, there were a couple of other really great individuals that we need to talk about. And let's talk about a personal favorite of mine, Gunther Rolle.
Gunther was a very, very funny guy. He lived in this old house built in the 17th century from the stones of a 12th century castle. And I used to stay with him on occasion in Bad Reichenhall. And he and I and Kropinski and Falk and some of the others would go to the reunions together. But Gunther was a very interesting person because he came the closest next to Steinhoff and Galland of actually ending up in a concentration camp himself, all because of what his wife was doing there to him. But Gunther was a very pragmatic person. He admitted, like all the others, by 1943, late 43, early 44, they knew the war was over. So what could they do? They couldn't defect because their families were back home. You know, they weren't going to commit suicide because they were better men than that. So they just continued flying and fighting. And Gunther said something very, very succinct but very profound to me. He said, "A man knows his value when he's facing defeat, but knows his duty and still does it anyway." And that pretty much sums up the men in general.
Interesting point. And there's another individual, Steinhoff, who is just something of a living legend, not just for what he did during the war, but during the post-war and Cold War period in NATO. Talk a little bit about Steinhoff.
Steinhoff, and ironically, his daughter, Ursula Bird, lives in Arizona with her husband, Senator Mike Bird, but the Steinhoff family have been good friends of mine for decades. And Johannes Steinhoff was the most remarkable guy out of the collection for one reason only. Unlike Galland, who was pretty diplomatic, Steinhoff didn't have a diplomatic bone in his body. And he's one of the few guys that actually told Goering he was an idiot to his face and told Hitler that you got to go clown here. You know, you need to get rid of this guy. He's killing people for no good reason. But Steinhoff was an individual himself. He was a good stern leader. He was a good fighter leader. Gallen called him the best squadron leader, the best fighter leader in the Luftwaffe, along with Rabach. But Steinhoff didn't suffer any fools gladly. If he saw a problem, if he thought you were incompetent or if you were short in your intellect, he would point it out to you, regardless of what your rank was.
And let it be said that these kinds of, shall we say, talking truth to power didn't exactly go over well in Nazi Germany, especially towards the end. And one of the results was that the very first of the serious jet units flying the famous ME-262 was all but a penal unit towards the end of the war.
Pretty much, yeah. JG-7 was the formation that was created after the remnants of Commando the Luftwaffe, after November 8, 1944. That's a good story because Gallen had so angered Goering that Goering wanted him dead. And Hitler said, I can't just kill the guy because he's a national hero, he has the diamonds. No, you can't just kill him. So let him go off and fight and fly his jets and do what he wants to do, and he'll probably die anyway. We'll bury him a hero and leave it at that. Goering didn't like that idea, so Goering put a contract out on him. He wanted to assassinate him, and Gallen only found out about it because SS Gruppenfuhrer Felix Steiner, the SS general who was one of the most chivalrous SS officers, if there was such a thing, sent Gallen a personal bodyguard who had been Felix Steiner's adjutant, and he sent him a bodyguard and said, Goering wants you dead. My man's here to make sure that doesn't happen because I owe you because your men have saved my men so many times on the Russian front. I want to make sure you're okay. And Gallen said, thanks, I appreciate it. But that's how bad it got.
And let's face it, how can you not love a guy who pissed off Hermann Goering so much that Goering put the contract out on him and he still lived? He was a tough, tough guy.
Yeah, really. Well, the thing was that Gallen had such a loyal circle of people, both within and outside the Luftwaffe, that they closed ranks around him. In fact, Gallen was shielded from the details of the Stauffenberg plots, as were Steinhoff and others, because they knew the senior officers. And I confirmed this by speaking to General Bernd von Freytag von Loringhoven, who was a direct participant who luckily survived Gestapo infiltration. But they were so loved by their men that they wouldn't undermine the war effort, but they did everything in their power to undermine the power Goering had.
I'd like to finish up our little vignette regarding the top German aces by talking about the top guy, the greatest, highest-scoring ace in the history of aerial warfare, Erich Hartmann, who nobody can deny literally fought a war that didn't end until 10 years after the end of World War II. Talk a little bit about Hartmann and his achievement, if you will.
Erich was a very special guy to me. He and his wife, Ursula, were wonderful people. And Erich didn't start flying combat until October, November of 1943. So he was a latecomer. So he only had just under 20 months to rack up 352 victories, but he was consistent. He wasn't a big scorer like Marseille, who scored 17 victories in one day, or Emil Lang, who scored 18, but he was a consistent shooter. But Hartmann's unique qualities about him was that, and Gallen called him the most immature officer next to Marseille because he liked to party with Kropinski too much, but Erich was a very, very strong character. And after the war, they were captured by the Americans under the Yalta Agreement. The Americans handed them over to the Soviets. And people who read the book will see the horrific things that happened to the civilians who were with them and what happened to Erich and the other guys in Siberia. But after 10 years of torture, isolation, starvation, and things of that nature, Erich and a few others came back. And most were broken men. But Erich was above that, and he managed to actually resurrect his career and thrive in that environment, even though he still locked heads with some of the new members of the German military and the political establishment. He and Steinhoff both, in fact. But to put Erich into context, Erich was, sorry to say, a young man who was thrown into a war that he really didn't understand, and he had to learn really quickly. about the politics involved after the Gestapo paid a few visits to the base to speak to Rawl and some of the others. And he learned about the Holocaust after the war, and that to him was the greatest shame of it all.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the fact that there is a legacy to these men. It's 70 years later, and we're looking back for the last time that we'll probably have these individuals. And I'd like to start with you, Anne. You've been intimately involved in the work you and your husband have done in promoting the memories and the stories of these individuals. What is the inherent value in your mind of Americans reading these books and learning about these men?
Well, I think it's really important for them to understand that there are people behind the process, behind the politics, behind the story. They were, in fact, men, and then they, you know, were great men in aviation. I found that there was a common thread that they all shared between both the American pilots and the German pilots from when I talked to the Black Sheep and the Doolittle Raiders and the Tuskegee Airmen. They all shared the common thread of wanting to fight and do the best they could for their country, and they all had a love of flight, and they wanted to see it change and evolve and become better and greater. And they all did amazing selfless acts in their work, in their flying, in their defense of their country. So the Americans can come out of it with a deeper understanding of the pilots and who they were as people, and find the common ground that they have as pilots that we do have with the Americans, in fact, because I did sit with the, with the Black Sheep and the Raiders and the Tuskegee Airmen, and they did share common ground and that they did understand. And in fact, I didn't find any bitterness on the side of the Americans. Like I said, I wasn't there for the Germans in the interviews, but the people that I spoke to on the side of the Americans, they were not bitter at all. In fact, they knew a lot about these men, and they admired their skills as aviators as well. So it was something you can come across, common ground.
Colin, our mutual friend Barrett Tillman, who just had his new book on the 15th Air Force come out today, I was talking to him before the show, and he makes the point that we're at the end. The last of these men are disappearing, going on to their just rewards. We're not going to have them anymore. What do you see as the value of what you've made your life's work for the past 30 years? How do you feel like you've spent your life, and do you feel like it was worth all the effort you put into it?
I do, and not just for the Luftwaffe guys, but all the guys I interviewed from dozens of countries, from different conflicts, different branches of service. But these guys are important because I think it's very critical that people understand that just because a man wears a uniform, doesn't, such as an American soldier, doesn't make him an Obama-supporting Democrat. He's an American fighting for his country regardless of his party affiliation. German soldiers, airmen, sailors, whoever they were simply individuals who did not have conscientious objective status, and there was no malaise accepted in the German military. So you either fought or you paid a price. And these men fought the best they could, and those who survived were lucky enough to tell me their stories. And I think that their stories are critical for understanding the mindset of the average German, not the stereotypical monocle-wearing, scarred-cheek individual in a bad film. I mean, look at the words of the men who paid a high price. Some spent a decade in the gulags, like Hartman. Some lost body parts or got burnt up almost death, like Steinhoff. These men fought a war. They didn't like it. They did it. They came back, and they tried to piece their lives together, and they welcomed me into their fold and said, let me tell you my story.
And I think that explains in many ways what the value of what you've done and what they've done is. And that said, what are you going to do next? What's next on the table for you? And I'm going to start with Anne. What do you and Colin have planned for your next set of projects?
Ooh, well, for the next set of projects that I'll be working on personally, essentially I'll be finishing up on a book that I'm writing on the 3 years that I was held in Beirut, and carrying on with my work and my research on Sharia law and its violations against women and children and its encroachment into the USA. I also have another project working on women in terrorism. So those are my areas of expertise that I work in conjunction with helping Colin get out the books on the interviews and the ACEs that he's interviewed over the years. So that's the primary focus that I'll be working on in the background. But Colin can speak to the other projects that we're working on.
Do you have a publisher for those earlier works set yet?
Right now I can't comment. No, I can't comment on that.
Well, good luck on finding one, because I would love to read your book about your 3 years in Beirut.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And Colin, where are you going with your body of work?
Well, I have two projects I want to start working on fairly soon. One is my interviews with American pilots, the American ACES speak, sort of like Eric Hamels, so I have to change my title, focusing upon American pilots, not just fighter pilots, but Jimmy Doolittle is, of course, one of them, Curtis LeMay and some others, who had a voice about what they did in the war and their perspectives. And then the other one is my interviews with the German pilots who were the specialists of knocking down the heavy bombers. I call it the giant killers. And these are the guys who, whether in jets or in piston-powered aircraft, scored bomber kills, and how they developed those tactics and techniques.
Sounds like interesting books, and I look forward to seeing them. I want to thank you both for coming on today. I want to thank you for sharing some of your time with us and sharing your books, and I hope we have a chance to talk to you again on Military Monday sometime soon.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and take care, both of you.
You too. Thanks. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
And with that, we come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. I want to thank Anne-Marie Lewis and Colin Heaton for coming on, as well as the fine folks at Zenith Books who made them available to us. As we said earlier, this is the 70th anniversary of the invasion of Europe, Operation Overlord, D-Day. Friday is going to be a day that we are going to see a lot of things happen in France. There will be commemorations. There will be speeches. There will be a lot of very old men who were very young men 70 years ago. These are the survivors of what Dwight Eisenhower called the Great Crusade. And I hope that we all take a little time, remember them, and quietly thank them in our own way. And I want to thank you for being with us today. We'll be back next week with another hour of Military Monday. And I think you're going to like our summer schedule. We've got some very interesting shows ahead. Thank you, and have a great week.
I took a flag pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. Got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. Cry. There's a baby on the doorstep wailing away. There's a baby on the doorstep longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep who gives his life to take. A flare through a pawn shop. A flare through a pawn shop. May he forget why he is crying so dear.